Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss Muldrow versus City of St. Louis, Missouri, in which the Supreme Court issued a 9-0 decision on April 17th, 2024. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, Allison Somit. Allison is a legal fellow on Pacific Legal Foundation's Constitutional Scholarship Team, and she focuses on separation of powers and equality and opportunity. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to our guest to discuss the overview of the case and the court's decision.
Thank you so much. So today I'm here to talk about Muldrow versus the City of St. Louis. It's a Title VII case dealing with employment discrimination. Usually Title VII cases involve big employment decisions, hiring, firing, promotion or failure to promote. In this case is about a St. Louis police officer who was transferred to a different department. She had a less favorable schedule in the new job, and she also lost access to her police car that she had earlier. And the question was, is this transfer the kind of adverse action that can allow her to state a claim for a violation of Title VII, the employment discrimination statute? In a 9-0 opinion, the Supreme Court held that it was. They looked to the text of Title VII, which bans discrimination in the terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. This prohibits discrimination in the types of big employment decisions that I ticked off earlier, but also in transfers of the type that happened to the plaintiff.
Right. That was really, really excellent. Just a great overview. And for people that don't know as much as you about Title VII, like myself, that is also really helpful. Can you kind of go a bit more into the reasoning that Kagan used right in the decision, and then maybe touch on some of the concurrences and the differences within the concurrences?
Sure. So in the circuit court below, Muldrow had lost. The Eighth Circuit held that there needed to be significant harm that would befall a plaintiff in order to make out a claim under Title VII. And the kind of transfer that happened to her was not held to be significant harm. This is a very textualist opinion. Justice Kagan said this. This statute prohibits discrimination in terms, conditions, or privileges. This requirement that there be significant harm is nowhere to be found in the statute. And indeed, oftentimes in discrimination cases, just treating somebody differently, even if there's not if there's not any kind of significant harm involved, it bestows a stigma, which is something that Title VII was crafted to avoid. She doesn't use this example, but you're probably familiar with the iconic movement against people sitting at the back of the bus. On its face, this is something that doesn't seem like it's necessarily significant harm. Everybody has to sit somewhere on a bus. But the stigma that came with having to sit in this particular place is what was at the core of the real harm, and that touched off the civil rights movement.
Great. So is it possible for you to just touch on each of the concurrences and you know what each is arguing for or against and that sort of thing?
Sure. So the concurrences are pretty brief. As I believe you alluded to in your opening, this opinion was 9-0. All the justices voted for the same bottom line. Justice Thomas wrote a brief concurrence in which he said that he agreed with the bottom line analysis. But what I think he said, and this is echoed later in Justice Alito's, he said that he's concerned that the court doesn't accurately characterize the Eighth Circuit's decision. He says that he does not read the Eighth Circuit to have necessarily imposed a heightened harm requirement in the form of a significance test. But even though he thinks that the court may have significantly mischaracterized what the Eighth Circuit said, he agrees with the bottom line result about what she would have to prove on remand.
Okay, great. And then Alito uses, I guess, some pretty strong language in the opinion, right? Basically saying that this opinion is quite unhelpful. The majority opinion is quite unhelpful, and that he doesn't know, basically, what it means. And can you go a little bit into that and what Justice Alito is looking at, and maybe some of the concerns that he may have?
Sure. So he says that the court's ultimate decision is that a plaintiff has to show that she demonstrated harm or injury, even if it's not necessarily the significant harm that the Eighth Circuit contemplates. His view is that when we say harm in everyday transactions, we usually mean something beyond what's minimally adverse to our interests. He has a couple great examples. We wouldn't say that the grocery store harmed us by not having our favorite brand of peanut butter, because using harm in that context, even though that's something that's minimally adverse, it's not something that we see as befalling us in a significant enough way to use that kind of word harm. The same thing with the word injury. Or I was injured because I ran into three rather than the usual two red lights on the way home from work. Yes, the three red lights is something that's a little bit adverse to us, but using injury there seems histrionic and inconsistent with how 99% of normal humans use the English language. So given that the words harm and injury seem to incorporate some level of materiality harming our interests, he seems to think that the difference between this test and the test the Eighth Circuit was using will often come out the same way.
Okay, and then Justice Kavanaugh also had a similar argument in terms of that he expects the court's approach, right, to pretty much be the same in almost all cases, if not mm-hmm. all of them. What do you see, maybe a couple of years in the future, 10 years in the future, how does this really change how Title VII is maybe interpreted by lower courts? Does it, or is there, will there be a substantial change, or at least some sort of change that we'll be able to see?
So I think the concurring opinions raise a good point about how in practice the Eighth Circuit test and the test enunciated by this court might tend to collapse into one another in a large percentage of real life situations. I think that this might make a small difference in some situations where it seems like there's some injury to the plaintiff, but it's not the most traditional kinds of injuries, like hiring, promotion, firing, what have you. I think another thing to keep in mind is that not necessarily everything that violates Title VII actually makes it to court. If you think that you've been discriminated against, you still have to get an attorney to represent you. And since many Title VII plaintiffs don't have a lot of money to pay up front, somebody who's willing to work on contingency, who's willing to shepherd you through the pendency of your case. And so if your harm is that you're transferred to a less physically attractive office, this is one of the hypos that came up during oral argument, and you think this happened because of your race or your sex, well, is somebody really going to want to walk you through 2 or 3 years of litigation when it's very likely the damages to you that you'll get for this are extremely low, are not going to be enough to pay your attorney? Maybe you can get a public interest firm or a student clinic to represent you, but those people also have lots of people vying for their free services. So that's another thing to keep in mind in terms of a natural constraint on who can bring Title VII claims.
And do you have any concluding thoughts on maybe the ramifications of this and of the decision overall?
I do have two different thoughts. So number one, we're seeing a lot of kind of non-traditional employment cases challenging employers' use of DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Some of these, for example, deal with mandatory or not mandatory, but strongly urged employer trainings, some of which contain very nasty or offensive materials about people based on race, that call all white people colonialists, that break people up into groups based on race, that classify people arbitrarily as oppressors or oppressed based on race without looking at individual circumstances. Understandably, many people find these offensive, and some people have gone so far as to try to take their employers into court for these trainings. So these don't seem to fit in the most traditional paradigm of Title VII, but nonetheless, these are offensive trainings that break people into groups by race, that make them feel the kind of stigma and shame based on race or based on sex, national origin, that seems to be in the heartland of Title VII. My public interest law firm, the Pacific Legal Foundation, represents a gentleman named Joshua Demert. Joshua Demert was a social worker in Seattle in a very liberal office. He got great reviews at his job, helped probably hundreds of kids over the years fit into their families, but nonetheless started to butt heads with some of his coworkers when the city of Seattle adopted a bunch of offensive trainings. He had to sit in a separate group because he was white. He was told that he was an oppressor because of his race. The list goes on. It's really quite a crazy story. Things eventually got to the point where he felt that he was forced into constructive resignation. And so he's now bringing a suit against the city, represented by some of my colleagues at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Because he eventually resigned, I believe that in his circumstances, there's not going to be the same kind of issue with showing harm. But in other types of cases, the question is somebody who's been subjected to this kind of training, does this rise to the level of being a Title VII violation potentially? And I think that even though this particular case deals with somebody who's facing a very different kind of harm under Title VII, Jatanya Muldrow is a Black woman. She's complaining about a transfer that she understood to be unfair and based on her race and her sex, not a DEI training. But I believe at the margin, this opinion will help people who want to bring actions against their employers based on offensive DEI trainings. The second thought that I had is that I wanted to speculate about the interplay between disparate impact and disparate treatment in these cases. There are two main types of anti-discrimination law on the books. One deals with disparate treatment, and this is the kind of case that was kind of thing that was happening in Muldrow. This is somebody who believes that she was treated differently on the basis of her race and her sex, and she believed that her employer was actually individually targeting her based on those characteristics. There's also what's known as disparate impact laws, and in employment, that makes illegal policies that have a differential effect based on race, sex, national origin, et cetera, even if the employer wasn't actually intending to discriminate based on that characteristic. So for example, the EEOC in recent years has done a lot with employer criminal background checks. In many cases, the employer isn't using those because the employer intends to target a particular racial group, but because the employer wants to weed out people that with what he or she sees as having undesirable characteristics relating to dishonesty, propensity for stealing, propensity for fighting at work, that kind of thing. So it's one thing to say that employment discrimination, it's one thing to use disparate impact with regard to big things like hiring, firing, et cetera. I think it's a significant overreach for the government to tell employers essentially that they need to have perfect proportionality when it comes to who they hire, who gets fired, et cetera. Once you're importing that same kind of broad liability untethered to intent for every little thing employers could do, you could challenge your employer because of the disparate impact that his or her office assignment policy has, or his or her transfer policy, even when there's no intent to discriminate, just because there's a disproportionality, that potentially hugely widens up the scope of liability under Title VII and could put some employers on the hook for true trivialities. The court doesn't really engage with that in this opinion. I understand why. This isn't a disparate impact case. This wasn't before the court, but this is something where I'm concerned about runaway plaintiffs bringing these actions or the EEOC really getting granular if it wants to be aggressive in enforcing this sort of thing. And possibly Congress should step in and clarify to make sure that the EEOC isn't actually demanding that people have proportionality over in every aspect of life in the workplace.
Well, thank you so much, Allison, for joining us. That was a really great overview. And also,
had not thought about those ramifications that you just mentioned. So definitely something to look out for in the future. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. Founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.